Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, February 24th. Fraudster alert. Losses are up nationwide and here in Hawaii. What you can do to be a fraud fighter. Got Social Security issues? Well, you may want to find out about a town hall meeting where you can get your questions answered later this week. New details emerge on the proposed deal between two healthcare giants. Why Queens Health Systems didn't get in on the deal when it had the chance. We learn more about why we are losing our native birds to avian malaria spread by mosquitoes, what clues the parasite leaves us to stop its spread. And we take you deep into a sweaty mosh pit and remember Honolulu's punk rock scene in the 80s and 90s. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At this hour, Maui residents are at a gathering to talk about why cases of fraud are up in Hawaii and what we can do about it. Doug Shadell is a fraud expert who spent years in law enforcement and with AARP in Washington State. He spoke with AARP members in Honolulu yesterday and will be on the Big Island later this week.
Fraud in general has skyrocketed in recent years. Just in a single year between 2023 and 2024, the reported number of cases nationwide has increased 25%. But a big chunk of that is this whole use of Bitcoin ATMs, where almost $1 million was lost just to folks in Hawaii in a single year. One of the messages of our events is to better understand how con men get people into an agitated, heightened emotion state, and then exploit them once they're in that state. So we gave them a number of examples of how technology is making that easier to do, how it's harder and harder to identify the true source of information, and why you have to be skeptical anytime you get an unsolicited email, phone call, text, whatever. And part of the point of the events is to train folks to become fraud fighters so that they are not only looking out for themselves, but looking out for their neighbors.
I like that, fraud fighters. You know, and, you know, because we have, you know, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, you know, trying to understand what the pitfalls are may take some time.
Well, the approach hasn't really changed in terms of how scammers practice their craft. I've been studying this for many years, longer than I want to admit. But when you ask scammers, we've interviewed dozens of them, what is your main strategy for defrauding people? They always give you the same answer, which is you need to get the victim into the ether. And at first I heard that word, I'm like, ether, what is that? It's slang for get them into a heightened emotional state, whether it's fear of losing something or whether it's excitement because you've just won the publisher's clearinghouse or whatever. Because once you're in that ether state, you're not thinking clearly. So currently, you know, I've studied this for a long time. Of those two, getting people excited about winning money versus fear, fear is winning. A lot of these scams that involve Bitcoin ATMs start with, and we played a tape at the event of a guy pretending to be the Honolulu Police Department, where it's like, hello, this is Sean Casey from the Hawaii PD. And you miss jury duty, and you're going to be arrested if you don't immediately send me $1,000, $2,000. That puts people into this ether state, that fear state, and then they take it from there. They tell them to go down to a Bitcoin ATM because that's the only way that you can securely send the money or whatever else ruse they have.
I have to interject here because just this week, my son texted me and said, Mom, because he got that phone call and he said it was so darn convincing.
Yeah.
And so I can relate to that. And I know that, you know, the law enforcement did put out a warning about this just in the last couple of weeks about, you know, the jury duty scam. But no, very convincing. And you don't have to be a senior to fall prey to that.
No, that's right. And, you know, what really angers me the most, having been in law enforcement, is it's preying on people's sense of doing the right thing. Well, if I owed money, I better pay it, right? It's exploiting people's sense of, I want to do the right thing, and take it from there. What I was going to say is, one of the other things is con men tell us, is you got to keep them under the ether because emotions are fleeting, right? You might be afraid 1 minute, then somebody says, oh, that's a scam, and now you're not afraid anymore. So they keep them on the phone. Stay on your cell phone, get in your car, drive to the Bitcoin ATM, and we'll tell you how to withdraw money from there. One con man told me, I need to keep them in the altitude of the ether because if I ever drop them into the valley of logic, then I will have lost them. Meaning, oh, well, once I wake up out of this fear state, I realize I don't know who this guy is on the phone, right? And so we see a lot of that going on. And these Bitcoin ATMs don't commit the fraud, but they make it easier and easier to get the money quickly. And what the scammer will do is give the victim a QR code to say, you don't have to worry about all the logging in and creating accounts. We'll just give you a QR code. Well, it's a QR code to the scammer's account. So when you put the cash in the machine using that QR code, you're giving it directly to the scammer, and then you never see it again. So yeah. That's we're warning people about that as well.
Yeah, and you know that's the problem, right, with this new type of currency is that it's very difficult to trace and track down.
Absolutely. Virtually impossible once you've given the money over. You're right about that.
I know that law enforcement is very concerned just about how so many of our seniors, though, fall prey to scams. And, you know, maybe it's a generation that's more trusting, but it certainly does pay to check with people just to verify numbers. And it's just crazy how good these scammers are.
It really is. And your guess is as good as mine about why it is that over 40% of the frauds using cryptocurrency in 2024 involve people over the age of 60. They are the ones losing the most amount of money. Could it be that we, because I'm in that category, right? I'm 68. We're not digital natives, and so it's easier to trick us when it involves something like digital currency. I'm not sure. Whatever it is, that is the population that's being targeted here. The population, you know, we've done studies that sort of try and determine what makes people vulnerable to these scams. And one of the ones, the last study I did before I left AARP, we surveyed 3,000 people who had all been approached by a scam. 2,000 of them resisted. 1,000 of them lost money. What was the difference between those two groups? The groups that lost money had experienced twice as many stressful life events in the months leading up to the encounter compared to the group that could resist. Well, who is that? I mean, everybody experiences stressful life events, but we're talking about people who have been taking care of a loved one, getting over an illness, getting over an injury yourself. That's our kapuna, right? That happens more often to older people. And the theory underlying that is that if you're coping with all this stress in your life, it takes away from cognitive capacity you might otherwise use to spot and defend against these scams. If you're managing your husband's sick and you're taking care of him, then the phone rings and somebody says you're going to go to jail if you don't pay money. In any other situation, you might say in the cool of day, no, I don't owe money. Go to, you know, you hang up on them. But if you're distracted, it's easy to sort of say, well, I better take care of it. But that's kind of what's going on, I think.
In your years of studying this, I don't know, was there any one particular case that just kind of stayed with you?
Geez, I mean, there's so many. I can tell you this, one reason I went from being an investigator to being a consumer educator is the last case I worked on in the AG's office, I spent a year tracking this guy who was selling bogus investments to seniors. This was in Vancouver, Washington. We finally got enough to sue him, served him with papers, and he moved 30 miles south to Portland and started a new company, right? He was back in business. And I said, you know, the prosecutors do all they can, and I hope they continue to do that, but I'd like to get to people before the scammer gets to them because it's really frustrating to spend a year building a case and then all you really did was move the guy 30 miles south. That was the case I remember.
Yeah, you know, and here in Hawaii, we hear stories, you know, from our aunties and our uncles and our cousins about, oh gosh, we just lost a bunch of money because of a scam, you know, in a weak moment, someone fell prey. And you do wish that you could have prevented that loss.
Yeah. And so, you know, the other call to action here, now that we've trained all these fraud fighters, right, is I find the people who go to these events probably are already armed, you know, and won't lose money themselves. But please, you probably all know somebody who lives alone or who's experiencing stress or who is vulnerable. Take this information out and just remind them of what these things look like and how they do it and how they approach you, so you won't have to chase after them after the fact.
I think many people then feel ashamed when they've been scammed and they don't want to admit it. But yeah, we've got to help fortify our friends and our neighbors.
And I know AARP, and I completely agree with this, has a whole campaign about don't blame the victim. Because first of all, it's not the victim's fault. But secondly, if people feel ashamed and don't report, then law enforcement doesn't know what's going on. The only way they can take action is if people tell them what's going on. So it's very important to not be ashamed and to report this if it happens to you.
That was fraud expert Doug Shadell, who's been talking to communities across the islands about AI and cryptocurrency scams in the state and steps to take to avoid becoming a victim. We'll have information about his upcoming seminars in Hilo and Kona on our website after today's show.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, offering tips to help local residents and businesses prepare for natural disasters and emergencies. Learn more at hawaiigas.com/safety.
Hawaii's Social Security offices lost more than 10% of its staff since March of 2024. So what does that mean for wait times and service for the 300,000 recipients in the islands? Well, this morning, AARP Director Kaili'i Lopez talked with us about a town hall meeting happening Thursday morning with Social Security Administration Commissioner Frank Bisignano. Lopez says it's vital that seniors report any problems with service to AARP and our members in Congress.
Our congressional delegation is working really hard to make sure Social Security services continue to improve rather than slide back. So they're going to want to hear from folks if there are issues. One of the things we're hearing from the Social Security Administration is that even though they have lost quite a bit of staff, Congress recently provided $50 million earmarked specifically for customer service improvements. So Social Security Administration is going to be working at, you know, how to go about hiring staff, lowering wait times and appointment times. But again, that's their intention. We want to know what people are really experiencing. You know, one of the things, Catherine, we talked about with you a while back is the wait time. So my understanding is that that's improved a little bit, but what's still a challenge is definitely people being disconnected, getting their phone calls back, and that type of thing. So it's really helpful to hear from folks to understand how bad it is. We have a teletown hall coming up this Thursday with Social Security Administration Commissioner Bisignano, and that's going to be at 8 a.m. Hawaii time. And we encourage people to participate, and it's going to be an opportunity for AARP to have questions asked of the commissioner about the programs.
I think last year when we talked, you know, I had learned that the Social Security office in Honolulu was not taking walk-ins anymore. And I, you know, only learned that because I went down there, and, you know, that was something that had just been discontinued. And I think at the time when I did talked to someone down there. You know, they were on the phone for, I think it was like 4 hours. And so it's very disconcerting, you know, when you hear stories like that. But, you know, hopefully then with this seminar, if people have questions, that they will be able to hear directly from the director.
Yes. And the important thing is to sign up early, because there's an opportunity to actually type in and provide your questions in advance. And the best way for people to register for that is to go to aarp.org/Social Security, just one word, Social Security, and they can register for that teletown hall. Again, it's Thursday, February 26th, from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Hawaii time. The one thing that AARP is going to continue to do is work really hard at trying to, again, working with Congress and the Social Security Administration to improve services. We know that tens of millions of older adults rely on Social Security, and it's one of the things that we work really hard at fighting for. So again, being able to know what the real impact is, because our understanding is they're working hard to try to make improvements, but we want to know if there really are improvements or if they're still continuing to have problems. So again, you know, we understand that the wait time is lower and that people are able to still get appointments. But again, if that's not the case, it would be really good to be able to hear and know from people what those challenges are.
And the money that's in the budget, we have no way of knowing if that's actually going to hire more warm bodies or if they're going to just put that money toward AI, you know, or some other system that they think is going to be more efficient.
That we don't know. What we do know is just that that money was earmarked specifically for customer service improvement. But you're right, the strategy that the Social Security Administration might choose to employ could be hiring more people, could be utilizing other technologies, you know, to make it more efficient. In the end, what we want to know is whether people are getting what they need when they need it.
I think, you know, one concern that folks might have is that, you know, we've watched the federal government take steps to regionalize certain federal agencies. And I know that in Guam, I think the Small Business Administration office was shut down. And then all the customers there were being routed under Hawaii. So that meant the workload for the SBA office here in Hawaii, you know, was being impacted, even though they didn't lose any staff, so to speak. So, you know, you just wonder how that concept of regionalizing services is going to play out.
That is a concern. And I think it's, again, the key piece there is, you know, do they actually deliver on the customer service that people want and need? And that's what we need to be able to know. Because the only way, you know, one, our congressional members are going to know and or AARP will know is being able to hear from Social Security recipients and hear their real stories. So again, at least here in Hawaii, we haven't heard anything yet from folks, but I do encourage people to please reach out to us. Again, that's HIAARP@AARP.org, and definitely contact their members of Congress who are very keen, like AARP, to hear and know whether what the Social Security Administration has indicated it will do is in fact benefiting Social Security recipients.
Yes, because, you know, it is money that we have all paid into, and we want to make sure that we get those services when we need them.
Absolutely, absolutely. A delay in services is not acceptable, especially if, you know, one of the things that has continued to occur is people have continued to receive their Social Security checks. That's not stopped. The challenge is you need to be able to sign up for it and be able to begin receiving those benefits. And especially those with disabilities, is there can be some delay. So again, I think making sure that we and members of Congress are aware of what those challenges are would be really greatly appreciated. This is definitely a national issue overall in regards to looking at customer service and ensuring it's being improved. But of course, here in Hawaii, we care about what our Hawaii residents are experiencing. The other key thing that AARP is going to continue to push on and want to make sure people are aware of is we absolutely still need Congress to make changes to the program so that the cliff that's projected for 2034 does not occur. If Congress does nothing, the come 2034 current Social Security recipients are estimated to get a 20% reduction in their benefits. So we have to, and that's where AARP is pushing to get Congress to deal with the issue sooner than later. The challenge is, as we've seen with many situations, Congress waits until it's right up against a wall. And that's maybe what's needed when, you know, people have to make compromises that they really would rather not unless they're forced to. Our preference is that they do that sooner and come up with a proposal that's well thought out and has had an opportunity to get engagement with the community and the public to understand what those implications are.
That was AARP Hawaii Director Kayla'i Lopez, who we spoke with this morning. AARP says, here in Hawaii, 1 in 5 residents are on Social Security, which pumps some $6 billion into our economy. We'll have the details for Thursday's town hall meeting on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
The president may believe that he'll go down in history as the one who solved America's long-running conflict with Iran. But if the president decides to take military action in the next few days or weeks, I suspect that historians will look back at this moment as a war of choice, not a war of necessity.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
You know, we're still waiting for more details about the proposed deal between Hawaii Pacific Health and HMSA, the state's largest healthcare insurer. The new healthcare model that was announced last month is still awaiting scrutiny from regulators. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Stuart Yurton does a deep dive into the story today. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so you really tried to unpack this deal. You know, we know that Queens Medical Center pushed back on the plan, but you also in your article talk about how it was approached first initially.
Yeah, that's right. And really what we're trying to do with the article is get to the why of this. Why? We know what people are saying. We know Queens is saying they're skeptical about it. We know that HMSA and Hawaii Pacific Health are saying it's a good thing. We really wanted to get to the question of why. Why are they saying this?
And, you know, we've got some time, I guess, before the federal regulators, you know, decide yay or nay on this. But you took the time to talk to doctors about what this change could mean for them.
Yeah, we did. We wanted to understand from the doctors. We talked to all sorts of people, many people off the record, just on background, gaining an understanding of this. And again, you know, when you look at doctors, you look at the doctor shortage. Many people are familiar with the doctor shortage, how hard it is to find a primary care doctor. So we wanted to look at why is that the case, and then why do the HMSA, Hawaii Pacific Health people, say this could help? Why others are very skeptical about that? And again, the article really explains why that is. That was our attempt and our goal.
And HMSA, you know, points out that these various entities have all been losing money, which is, you know, the reason why they say we need to do something bold. But your article does include, you know, a number of graphs to try and explain, you know, what could be a very kind of dense deal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the story behind that is, in order to understand it myself, I ended up having this whiteboard and drawing things out. It looked like spaghetti. I ran it by Hawaii Pacific Health people and their communications team working with One Health. And I'm like, is this right? They said, yeah, that's actually remarkably accurate to what they're trying to do. The challenge was taking that spaghetti and putting in something that people could read and understand. And our team, including April Estrelan, our graphics journalist, really did a good job, I think, of boiling it down and explaining kind of the current model, what that looks like, and what the One Health model would look like.
And the thing with this model, I know folks were talking about, you know, we need to have shared risk.
Yes. What does that mean? It means many things. Risk sharing in the healthcare world can mean many different things. In this particular case, we describe what that particular type of risk sharing means, how it's affecting doctors now that are using it, and what One Health wants to do to modify this, in some ways expand it, expand the current risk-sharing models that people don't like, but tweak it in a way that it could work for people. And again, getting back to your thing with Queens, I think a big question from Queens is this risk-share, they're calling it a risk-bearing entity, is the risk-bearing entity going to be willing to take on a lot of the risk that Queens has with its population of uninsured people, of people who need a lot of care, patients who don't always follow exactly what the doctors want them to do for all kinds of reasons? If not, it's probably not going to work for Queens. My guess is if this risk-bearing entity would take on the risk and cost of all those people, maybe it works. But again, that's the kind of thing that's going on. I believe that's one of the pressure points we try to identify in this article.
Yeah, well, I think if people really want to try and understand whether this is a good or bad thing for Queens or for Hawaii in general, yeah, it's worth drilling down and reading the article, as you tried to break down what this deal means. But thank you so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine. Yeah, this is really a jumping off point for people, but thank you so much.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton. You can read his article online at civilbeat.org. It's estimated that avian malaria can kill up to 90% of certain native bird species like the ieve, but different birds harbor different amounts of the malaria parasite. So how much is enough to do real damage? Well, Krista Seidel is with the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project. She was a doctoral student at the University of California, Santa Cruz, when she started analyzing blood samples from more than 4,000 birds across the state. Seidel spoke with the conversation's Maddie Bender about what she found.
So this work came from me personally, from a deep love of Hawaiian ecosystems and seeing the threat avian malaria was posing to our native birds here in Hawaii. And so I took on a project that I thought would help better explain and understand which bird species were the key contributors to avian malaria transmission, and then using that information eventually, hopefully for conservation purposes. And so ultimately, we've known now for decades that many bird species in Hawaii can get avian malaria. But what we didn't know is how those different species were contributing to transmission. We were able to do that for some of the native bird species, which have been studied for quite a few decades now, but less understood was the role of non-native birds. And with improvements in our ability to detect malaria in blood samples, we were finding increasingly more birds with quite a variety of different parasite loads, including really, really low levels of the parasite in their blood and really high levels. And once we were able to quantify those numbers, we wanted to know, are birds with these low levels in particular, are they infecting mosquitoes? Because in a lot of disease systems, they aren't. And that's actually good news because that's fewer individuals transmitting the disease.
What did the breakdown for our native birds look like?
Great question. So overall, we did see that native birds were more likely to have higher parasite loads and were thus more likely to infect mosquitoes than some of the non-native birds. But there were non-native birds, both individuals and species, that had both parasite loads and, let's say, the average parasite load that were comparable to some of our native birds. And so there are whole communities of birds that have no native species that are transmitting avian malaria and likely have individual bird species. For example, we did find that many house finches are infected with avian malaria and seem to have higher levels of parasite in their blood. So when present, it seems like they are often contributing to avian malaria transmission. And it may even be that mosquitoes prefer to bite them. We used prevalence of malaria in different bird species as a somewhat marker of which species mosquitoes like to bite. Because another interesting thing folks might not know about is that mosquitoes have preferences. They don't indiscriminately bite things. They often are attracted to certain animals or certain bird species over other ones. And so they can really amplify the role an individual species has in transmission. And we did not have the blood sampling data that would really cinch the deal for this. And those would be incredible next steps. It is really hard to get mosquitoes with fresh blood samples inside of them. But if we were able to get that, we could probably even better understand which individual species mosquitoes prefer to bite. But based on our estimates using prevalence data, Hawaii amakihi, which is a native bird, apapane, also a native bird, seem to be preferred by mosquitoes. And then, as I said, house finches, which are a non-native bird. Conversely, warbling white eyes, the little Majiro birds we see outside that are super common, don't seem to be preferentially bitten by mosquitoes.
How related were the questions you were asking in this study to the question of why avian malaria is so deadly to Hawaii's native birds?
Yeah, so frequently, birds with really high parasite loads, think about it as how it's measured when we measured it in the study is the percentage of your red blood cells that are infected by a parasite. So we were getting birds that had sometimes 30+% of their red blood cells. So that's, you know, almost a third, if not higher, of their red blood cells that have parasites in them. And ultimately, a lot of those red blood cells are going to rupture and they're no longer functioning. So they're not carrying oxygen to the, you know, the bird's organs, and those birds become incredibly anemic. And so at best, they're a little sluggish and sleepy until they can recover, which may make them more susceptible to predation by introduced mammals. At worst, I mean, we're looking at failure of your organs. Basically, you're not being able to, you know, breathe in some ways and oxygenate your tissues. So for some of those birds, it's quite deadly. And for native birds who often have those higher levels of parasite in their blood, they're the ones who are going to suffer higher levels of morbidity and mortality.
Since you conducted this research for your PhD, since then you have gone on to work at Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project. Are there ways that a study like this and investigating these types of questions have affected how your group is doing its mission? any other reflections you might have now seeing academia from a different side?
When I did this PhD, right, I didn't necessarily think I would be in the applied space. And it's interesting to see that some of the conclusions from this work suggest that mosquito control, for example, is really important because there are now, we surveyed over 64 sites all across the Hawaiian Islands. 63 of those had avian malaria in them, and some were, you know, basically near the ocean at sea level, and some were up in the native bird habitat, pretty high elevation where we think there's very low transmission of avian malaria and very few mosquitoes. So many of those sites had malaria, and it pretty much showed that it's everywhere, and it's going to be particularly in places where both mosquitoes and the pathogen can develop. And so there's not a lot of like safe places for the most susceptible birds anymore. And the way we could make them safe is by reducing transmission and particularly reducing mosquito populations. We can't just target any one bird species. We can't assume that if we translocate a bird from one place to another place, that that other place will be safe from avian malaria because there aren't mosquitoes. It could be that some of the birds there have avian malaria, and if we have seasonal mosquito spread into those areas, we could get transmission events. So it's kind of just one of those things that while the work is almost, it's overwhelming to think about how widespread avian malaria is, it also gives us hope that, you know, one of the tools to getting rid of it is to reduce the vector that spreads it around. And then another thing that I like about this in an interesting way is that there is no other choice for the birds than to develop some sort of ability to deal with avian malaria. Because even if we're suppressing mosquito populations perfectly, the birds are going to start to move downslope. They're going to recolonize a lot of the habitat that they've been extirpated from. But unless we remove every single mosquito, which is very unlikely, there will still be transmission of avian malaria. So they're going to have to evolve adaptations to dealing with it. And we've already seen this in some species. We just got to give them enough time to develop those adaptations. And so we've seen it in Amakihi. It's been documented on a few islands. We think it's happening in Apapane. We have captured a few kiwiku on Maui that have avian malaria and are still alive and reproducing with it. And we've caught them now multiple times and they've tested positive multiple times. So I think that's a good sign for us practitioners to show like we've got to protect those individuals and spread their genes. And if we can just keep malaria transmission low and suppress the mosquitoes enough, we're more likely to get those events. And so those were some of the interesting like practical takeaways in hindsight from this work that I did prior to doing any sort of conservation management.
Well, is there anything else that you'd want to add or you'd want listeners to know about this work?
I think another interesting thing that's not super well known, though we were able to quantify a bit in this study, is that a number of particularly native birds, but likely other non-native birds, have quite long periods where they can be infected with malaria. And we were able to show that it's instead of that initial first few weeks where birds often have really high parasite loads. So an individual, as you might recall, there's the whole relationship we saw with the curve and COVID where you spike in the early days and eventually that spike of your parasite level or pathogen level goes down and then often goes to zero for most people. With avian malaria, in many bird species, it doesn't completely go down to zero. And for many years, sometimes, yeah, months to years afterwards, they have low levels of malaria. And so this chronic, we call it, period of infection is likely the main driver of transmission, which is also different than a lot of disease systems. It's usually that initial first week or two that you have your highest pathogen loads, that's most important for infecting others. But we think that with avian malaria, it has pretty much adapted to being spread often in that like long latent period where there's very, very low levels of parasite in the bird's blood. And that's just unique, I think, for so many pathogens all across the world. And that was an interesting thing to describe in this work.
That was mosquito researcher Krista Seidel in HPR's Maddie Bender. Seidel's report was published early this month in the journal Nature Communications. Look for a link on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, for over 87 years committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
President Trump promised to lower costs, crack down on illegal immigration, and usher in a new golden age. But after a full year back in office, he's preparing to deliver the State of the Union address with his lowest approval rating this term. I'm Tamara Keith. We'll bring you his speech and the Democratic response. Join us for live special coverage and analysis from NPR News.
Beginning this afternoon at 4.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the Master of Human Resources Management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
Being a punk in Hawaii is a hard knock life. Just ask Speedy Lopez. It's been his life and includes getting jumped outside of bars. Now it's the subject of a new book, Local Unrest. It explores the story of Hawaii's punk rock music scene. Lopez interviewed more than 100 people to compile a far-ranging oral history. He talked to The Conversation's Kevin Allen and starts with what drove him to put the project together.
I've always been interested in music, and you know, half my jobs have been music-related, so I would always read these books about different music scenes, you know, the New York hardcore punk scene, the LA underground rock scene, the Minneapolis rock scene. And it always got me thinking, you know, well, what were the origins of our scene here in Hawaii? I mean, we've got the same kind of music. I mean, we have bands that made it to the top, you know, made it to major labels. I mean, nobody's told that story. So, you know, maybe I should try and figure this out and hunt the people down and get that story on paper.
And, you know, in the book, I think it's really interesting, too, because at the kind of at the front, you talk about how, you know, punk in most other cities is a counterculture thing, right? It's not the norm. And especially in Hawaii, I think that is doubly true, where a lot of Hawaiiana music was really popular at the time. And where Hawaiiana is clean, punk is about as dirty as it can get. I mean, you know, back in the day, how did it feel being a punk and really, I mean, really not fitting in with the culture at the time?
Yeah, there's a humorous part in this book where me and a friend who grew up in Kalihi were talking about how there were no punk rock kids back in those days, right? I mean, he actually said, I think you were the only kid in Kalihi who actually listened to punk rock back in the 80s, you know, like early, at least in the early 80s or so. And I thought about it. I was like, you know what? You're right. I don't think there were any other kids in our neighborhood that listened to it. So, I mean, I was okay with that. You know, we're kind of outsiders. My friends were like heavy metal headbangers, so they were kind of outsiders as well. So we kind of gravitated to each other, you know. We sort of related. And eventually they got turned on to punk rock as well through skateboarding, because that's sort of a parallel sort of pastime, you know. And I think a lot of people got turned on to punk rock through skateboarding, which really exploded in the 80s.
Absolutely. And I think it's really cool, too, in the book, you know, you kind of talk about, you know, these waves, the first big punk bands here kind of start emerging, the Squids and all these old names that, you know, maybe a lot of people don't even know about today anymore.
Yeah, that was really exciting for me. Like as a young teenager or even as a preteen, I would hear these bands and kind of follow them from afar, right? So I'd known about the Squids, even though I was in elementary school, basically, when they were big, you know, and a lot of these other bands that would come later. And then as a teenager, obviously, I'd get to sneak out of the house and start going to gigs and stuff. So that was really exciting to know that there are kids that are your age, maybe a little older, that were in bands, and you could actually do that yourself, right? I think that's the biggest appeal of punk rock is you can just go out and get a guitar, learn three or four chords with your friends, and you can have a band right away. You don't have to woodshed for years and until you become a guitar virtuoso. You can do it today if you wanted to.
And I think it's really interesting, too. You kind of talk about, in the book, a lot of these really, I don't want to say nefarious, but my goodness, the scene back in the 70s and 80s, it just was so much less regulated. There was a lot more raw, rough things happening. Talk to me about that, just about what it was like back in that time.
Yeah, I mean, hearing these stories from the older kids about what would happen at some of these clubs, I mean, you got to remember the drinking age did not change to 21 until maybe the mid to late 80s. So up until then, you could be 18 and go into a club legally. But most clubs, you know, if you looked the part, if you were like 15 or 16, you had a mustache, I mean, they'd let you in, you know? And I think a lot of the older people sort of from the scene back in the day kind of look at that as being the good old days.
Researching this book and doing the interviews, you must have heard a lot of stories about the good old days. What did you learn anything maybe, I guess, newer that you didn't know about when you were researching and writing this book?
I think the most shocking thing for me was like just the level of violence that occurred back then, you know, like that was a little bit surprising to me. I mean, in this book, you'll come across, there's a murder that happened that involved a nightclub owner. There were several shootings. Someone died in front of one of the nightclubs. A couple of doormen got shot at nightclubs here. And it's all in the book. I think a lot of people tend to look at the old days and think of them as the good old days where things were safer, but it's not necessarily true, you know? I mean, in my research, I found out that 1980 was actually probably the worst year in terms of murder here in Hawaii. And people wonder why, but you got to remember that there weren't security cameras on every block back then. The gun laws were a lot more lax, right? And I think bad people could get away with things a lot easier than they can today. So, yeah, there's a lot of violence in here, and it's pretty interesting. And I was shocked to come across a lot of it.
And I think one of my favorite parts about the punk rock scene is just how community oriented it is. You know, we stick up for each other, especially as maybe a more marginalized genre of music. And you touch on that in the book. You know, you talk about guys getting in fights and, oh, run back to the bar and we'll get all our guys. And, you know, then it's a huge brawl in the street.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think back in those days, especially when I talk to the older guys, they remember when they'd just be walking down the street and get accosted by people for the way they looked, and people would want to pick fights with them, and they'd have to band together just for safety. And the same goes for putting on shows. No bar or club would be interested in this type of music. So what they would do is they just have house parties or rent a rental hall, and they put on their own shows, and they'd invite their friends' bands, and they'd have a bill with 5-6 bands, charge $2 or $3, and they were a lot more active than people probably realize, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's funny too how some things don't change. I feel like that is still very much the case with a lot of punk music. It's a lot of just, hey, let's get our bands, let's find a place we can be loud, and we'll charge $5 at the door.
Right. The punk bands were like, well, nobody's ever going to be interested in this. Let's just do our own thing. Let's do it this weekend. We'll do it right away. My friends just started a band. Let's invite them over, you know, and it's a scene. That's how a scene starts.
It kind of comes with the territory. And I think in the book, you do a great job of kind of relaying what it feels like to be at a lot of those gigs or to hear these oral histories of like, oh, yeah, I mean, you know, whatever. Johnny broke his guitar through the PA and then barfed all over his amp. what is your maybe, I guess, favorite gig, your fondest or most notable gig memory that you just will be with you until the end?
I think the first one I ever went to was probably the most memorable for me, right? I had been into punk rock since I was maybe about 12 years old. So we're talking like early 80s. But it wasn't until I got into high school in the late 80s that I started going to gigs, because there were no other kids that I knew that were into the music, right? So I just kind of enjoyed the music by myself. So there was one. The first one I ever went to was, it was in Chinatown, and it was underground, and it was actually a converted laser tag kind of place. And they just invited punk bands into this laser tag facility. And that was my favorite. Yeah, that's got to be one of my favorite. But there was also one that you'll read in the book that happened at Club Hubba Hubba, which was probably the most infamous strip club in Honolulu and existed for decades. And there was a couple of gigs that were put on there that invited punk rock bands there. So that was really interesting to be in